Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dagina Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're talking to Dr. Fabio Famelli on a recently published edit volume that he co-edited with Andrea Castiglioni and Karina Roth, Defining Shugendo, Critical Studies on Japanese Mountain Religion, published by Bloomsbury Academics in 2020. Dr. Famelli, welcome to the show again.
Thank you, Dagina. Good to be here again.
Thank you. I wonder if you can begin the interview by saying something about yourself. I know that we've done introductions with you before, but say something about yourself for our listeners who are listening to this particular episode.
Okay, with pleasure. So I am Fabio Famelli. I hold a PhD from Italy, and I've been working on Japanese religions and I would say intellectual history for quite some time now. My main topic of interest has always been esoteric Buddhism, especially the Shingon tradition. And gradually I moved away from that or to the margins of that through like medieval Shinto, for example, and later like early modern developments and different aspects of Japanese religiosity that are normally kind of ignored or forgotten or downplayed. How I became interested in Japanese religions? This is a good question. So I immediately after, you know, at the end of high school, I enrolled in Japanese studies at the University of Venice in Italy. And the course that I was most really fascinated in was a course on the religions and philosophies of East Asia with a special focus on Japan. And at the time, I was interested in semiotics already, and like, you know, philosophy of language, you know, like theories of meaning and all that. And I thought that esoteric Buddhism in particular had a very articulate, very rich, sophisticated theory of meaning and the semiotics. And in fact, I wrote my MA thesis and then later the PhD on that. But that's really what got me interested in Japanese religions. I mean, not necessarily the cults or the beliefs, but more like the intellectual background, you know, the conceptual structure that Buddhism first and Shinto later kind of developed in Japan. So here I am.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really obvious from your work and also the edit volumes that you edited that you have a really kind of expansive and diverse academic interest with regard to Japanese religion. It's very impressive and exciting.
Okay, well, thank you.
Great. So first of all, tell us how the Defining Shugendo project began. So what brought the chapter authors of this book together to write on Shugendo?
This is kind of an interesting story because there was a time in 2016 and 2018 that Andrea Castiglioni and Karina Roth were both at the UCSB, at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where I also am. And it is quite of unusual to have three specialists of Japanese religions in the same place. Even, you know, it was just for a short period of time. So we decided to do something together. And both Andrea and Karina work on Shugendo. So we decided, why don't we do something on Shugendo that covers the most recent trends in scholarship? And so we did a conference in 2017, I believe, where we invited some of the leading scholars, and some people are doing very innovative research on Shugendo. And out of the conference, again, we decided to edit, to collect the papers and edit them. And the book is the result of that effort.
So for those of our listeners who might be less familiar with Shugendo, can you tell us briefly what it is? For example, its key beliefs and practices?
Yeah, you see, this is a difficult question because you would think that everybody knows what Shugendo is. And in fact, it's not very easy to define. So literally, the term means a way, though, of ascetic practice that should to attain miraculous results. And that is Gen. So basically, so there are practitioners of this and of this tradition. And in pre-modern times, those were professional religious activists called the Shugenja. So, you know, the people who practice and achieve miraculous results, or Yamabushi, those who hide in the mountains or something like that. So Shugenja or Yamabushi are the practitioners, the specialists of Shugendo. The beliefs of this tradition, so it's a very widespread and very diverse tradition, first of all, and the beliefs are centered on esoteric Buddhism, on Mikkyo, both Shingon, or I should say either Shingon and or Tendai, and they focus on the possibility to become a Buddha in this very body, you know, the concept of Sokushin Jobutsu, and they claim that it is possible to attain this Buddhahood and experience it through ascetic practices on specific sacred mountains. So you have groups of, like I said, professional ascetics who spend weeks, I mean, long parts of each year, or sorry, they used to, right, in pre-modern times, spend, you know, sizable portions of the year by peregrinating on specific mountains, and in particular, there is the spring peregrination and the fall peregrination, where these ascetic groups of ascetics like entered literally the mountains and went up and trekked specific paths on the mountains for several days, sometimes several weeks. We're talking about arduous and you know, treks carrying heavy equipment with ritual implements for hundreds of miles in the mountains, night rituals, fasting, and all kinds of activities. And the thousands of prayers, you know, along the way, to particular stones, to particular images of Buddhas that are, you know, made in stone along the way, in little halls on the mountains, to particular peaks, for example, that are considered to be embodiments of gods, and all that. And through this long and arduous process, all framed within, you know, concepts of esoteric Buddhism, with also influences from local cult traditions, like what we call Shinto, then practitioners experience, you know, like an altered sense of themselves, which they associated with some particular miraculous powers that they claim to possess. So I don't know if this kind of renders the idea. These are professionals. So what they do is not only like going around the mountains. I mean, when they are not in the mountains, they use the powers that they claim they have to perform religious rituals in villages and towns, to perform all kinds of services. They were also itinerant. So these groups were active in particular regions and areas. So they were traveling from one village and one town to the other, carrying goods like medicines, books, amulets, and like I said, performing rituals along the way. So this is what they did. Now it is a little different because very few of them are professionals, and those who are, I mean, they have their own temples, but others are kind of, I shouldn't say amateurs, but they have a different job, let's say, during the year, and during several days or several weeks of the year, they still go in the mountains and they do this type of ascetic practices.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really obvious from this collected group of essays that Shugendo is quite diverse, right? And I guess the problem of defining Shugendo becomes more complicated when we encounter, you know, representations of it in popular culture and poetry, right, as we will discuss later. So I guess the process of defining Shugendo will be an ongoing one, as this edit volume shows.
Yes, absolutely.
So the introductory chapter mentions that a primary intervention of this edit volume is to disentangle, Shugendo studies, discourses from the yoke of folklore studies and relocate them with the broader track of religious and historical studies. Please elaborate a little bit on this point and tell us more about what this edit volume is trying to do.
Answering your question, you know, implies like addressing the ways in which Japanese religions or Japanese religiosities have been studied in the academia over the past like 100 years or more. And this is, you know, well known, but there's been this significant bifurcation according to which religious studies traditionally, right, I mean, focuses on texts and doctrines, right? And then only later kind of rituals were brought in. But even so, the majority, the large part of religious studies of Japan today, and that is probably true also for other religious traditions, I'm not sure, but the majority of religious studies really focuses on like established Buddhism and their main authors in pre-modern times, so that you have books about Shinran, books about Dogen, books about Kukai and their thought and some of the practices that they did. Now, of course, this doesn't cover the entire spectrum because most people were not really exposed to any of these lofty teachings and sophisticated rituals that took place at the main temples near the capital of Kyoto, or perhaps in Tokyo, right? So Shugendo, in fact, covers a whole gamut of ritual and positions and beliefs that took place all over the archipelago of Japan for many centuries. So in this sense, it is really important. But it has been excluded by scholarship precisely because of its non-elite background, right? We're talking about like commoners' beliefs and commoners' rituals. Now, an exception is the fact that some scholars of Shugendo have emphasized the Shugendo textual tradition, and that enabled them, you know, to try to, let's say, nobilize Shugendo by putting it, you know, on par with other schools of esoteric Buddhism. But the large bulk of Shugendo studies is really part of folklore studies. And as you know, folklore studies is not really part of the academia, right? Especially in America. There are very few folklore specialists in general, and I can probably think of three folklore specialists focusing on Japan. So that means that a lot of what constituted the core of Shugendo has been basically excluded by scholarship. And by treating it as folklore studies, for the few who do, right, or who did, I mean, folklore is a kind of a debased form of religiosity, right? It's a kind of religiosity that is, well, I mean, this is not what I believe, but, you know, this is the way it is presented or the way it is conceived, right? It's very close to superstition. It's kind of an uninformed, illiterate, superstitious set of beliefs and practices. This has really powerfully marginalized the importance of Shugendo in Japanese culture and our understanding of it. So it is true that there is also a component of folklore studies that claim that folklore, it's really the essence, you know, the cultural essence of a people, which gets very close to cultural nationalism. And this is also a component of Shugendo studies as, you know, being conceived as part of folklore studies. So I think that all of these, you know, causes so many problems and ultimately obfuscates, you know, the importance of Shugendo in Japanese culture, that in this book we decided to take a very different perspective by following, you know, the most advanced scholars, both in Japan and elsewhere, who try to disentangle, like you said, you know, Shugendo studies from folklore. And we want to bring it back within religious studies, but in a broader sense, right? Religious studies as it is done today, right? That encompasses elite and popular cultures, central and marginal cults and all that. Teachings, doctrines, and rituals in a way that speak to each other. We don't believe that that commoners in villages were kind of ignorant of, and they had no doctrinal basis or no doctrinal understanding. Of course they did. I mean, they understood it in their own way, but their own way, it's important for us to understand. So this is what we are trying to do, bringing it back to in a broader conceptualization of religious studies, and also in a broader contextualization of history, because we can probably say a few things about, you know, historical approaches to Shugendo. I think it is important. See, one of the components, one of the assumptions of folklore is that it never changes, right? You know, folkloric ways are always the same since the most remote antiquity. And Shugendo has been treated in that way. So again, this is another problem, and that's why this book tries to present a very different and more open, we hope, image of Shugendo to the public.
Thank you. Yeah, this book it's in different parts, and all these different parts address very new approaches to looking at Shugendo material culture, popular culture, visual culture, narratives, and also rituals, right? Like you said. So we'll see through our discussion today how, you know, this will help us to kind of overcome this essential view of Shugendo as something sort of intrinsically Japanese or as some kind of national folklore.
Right.
So it'll be interesting. So the book is divided into four parts. Part one kind of discusses the historiography around Shugendo. It's entitled Intellectual History of Shugendo Studies. So tell us, how has Shugendo been studied so far, especially in academia? I guess we kind of briefly touched on this in the previous question. But how has Shugendo been studied both in and outside of Japan, and how these different academia kind of lineages differ?
Well, you see, what is interesting is that until very recently, there was no difference in the academic lineages. Basically, non-Japanese scholars were following the lead of Japanese scholars, and there are two or three main scholars. One is Gorai Shigeru, the other one is Miyake Hitoshi, and the third one is Suzuki Masataka, who is also a contributor of this book. And Suzuki is the one who has begun to, you know, move away from the legacy of his two predecessors. But basically, Gorai and to a different extent and in a different way, Miyake, have presented Shugendo as a folkloric, really nationalistic in a way, right? It's something that exists only in Japan. I mean, and according to them, and something that is historically unchanging in its essence. And Western or non-Japanese scholars have basically followed their lead. So this is where we stand until very, very recently. So that's why we thought that it is really important to address or to propose an intellectual history of Shugendo studies, right? To see how Shugendo studies has been conceptualized, by whom and why, and what, you know, were the motivations behind this type of research. And so basically the history of Shugendo studies, right? And that is something that, again, Suzuki Masataka wrote for this book. And it's really new. Because, like I said before, Shugendo is traditionally understood as something that dates back to the most remote antiquity. It is only and exclusively Japanese in its essence. Of course, you know, it encompasses things coming from India or China or Korea or wherever, but still the essence is Japanese, and that never changes. So this is the kind of image that you are trying to challenge. And in fact, this chapter here that you mentioned in part one shows how folklore shows how Shugendo was reinterpreted as part of Japanese nationalism. In the 30s and in the early 40s, when Japan needed to mobilize all its intellectual resources to strengthen the idea of this kind of national essence to support the war effort, then Shugendo, the importance of Shugendo is revived as a contributor to this ideological endeavor. And even before that, you have the idea that, again, the folk is the that comes from Germany, right? To this very very conservative and in the 20s and 30s very close to Nazism, to this kind of scholarship that emphasizing the folk as the essence of a nation and the folkloric ways as intrinsically different from and incommensurable from other cultures. And this was the dominant scholarship in the 20s and 30s in the world. And the Japanese pick it up and bring it back to Japan. So we think that it's really important, on the contrary, to emphasize the history of Shugendo, to see how it changed, not only regionally, which has been done to an extent, but also in terms of time, to see what happens at different historical periods and how the doctrines and the rituals are changed, how the groups, the agents involved in Shugendo change and what kind of things they do. And this is all very important. And I think we are very behind in trying to make a general assessment of the impact of Shugendo, on Japanese culture. But I think that this book is a good beginning, to begin to think about these questions.
Certainly, yes. As we will see in the following chapters, many of these authors are definitely challenging a lot of these notions, right, present in older scholarship. And part two takes us to four different Shugendo sites in Japan. So namely the Kumano Sanzan area in the Kii Peninsula, Mount Togakushi in Nagano Prefecture, Mount Haguro in Yamagata Prefecture, and Daigoji in Kyoto. So these four chapters review that Shugendo centers actually regulate a really complex networks based on symbiotic interactions between not just Shugendo professionals, but also Buddhist monks, lay members of religious fraternities, and also lay devotees. So how did these networks and interactions work? Can you give us a few examples?
This is, in fact, very, very complicated because I think we don't know enough to try to determine some general patterns. Of course, like you said, you have Shugendo professionals, the Yamabushi that I mentioned before. You have Buddhist monks residing at particular temples that are related to these groups of Yamabushi. And then you have lay devotees who support either the temples or the Yamabushi or both. And then you have religious confraternities who perform rituals in which Yamabushi, Shugenja are the leaders. But then you also have other aspects that further complicate the picture, right? So and again, the mix really changes. The weight of each of these groups changes according to the historical period and the locale. So the professional religious groups, you have the official temples, right? You have village authorities. You have lay confraternities. You have governmental authorities in the Tokugawa period in particular, right? You have the local feudal authorities and the Bakufu. Then you have the spread of like Shinto activists, and the Yamabushi are also kind of, interacting with them. And then you have practitioners of like mountain asceticism who are not Yamabushi, who don't belong to any specific Yamabushi group, but they have their own groups. And the confraternities are often in competition with each other. You have, for example, you have different groups of Shugendo professionals using the same mountains, but for different purposes and different parts of the mountains, like Mount Fuji, a group goes up from the north, the north slope, another group goes up from the south slope, and they are in competition. So you see all these kind of different things that happen, and it's very hard to study the interaction. So that's why it is really important to focus on one particular network, right? One particular mountain or one particular region where the mountain is located, and see who does what and why, right? And to whom. So these chapters here in part two are kind of beginning to trace these agents in multiple ways, in ways that I think has not been done sufficiently in the past. Because again, like I said, you have so many people, so many agents involved that you cannot really solve this only from within Shugendo studies, right? If you only study a Shugendo group or the doctrines of that particular Shugendo group, you really have no idea of what the Shugendo group is doing, when, where, to whom, right? And in competition to whom. So that's why I think it's really important to expand the scope and the perspective and place particular Shugendo groups in their mountains in conflict and collaboration with all other agents. And this is what these chapters are trying to do. I hope all of this makes sense. I mean, I know it can be quite confusing, but this is what, you know, this is what was going on the field at the time. Again, we're talking about the 1800s here. Now things are very different. I mean, in a way, they're much more, they've been simplified in many ways. But you can add other layers, right? You know, the role of women, for example. Women were off limits for most sacred mountains. So women can only go up to a certain level in the mountain, and then only men could go up. Then you have people working for the Shugenja while they are, you know, in their mountain, so providing, you know, food and, you know, ritual implements. So that's another network that was necessary for, you know, for these people, for these practitioners to do what they were doing. You have the role of, like, children, for example. How were the children acculturated within these Shugendo lineages and all that? And we know very little about all of this.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. It seems that studying Shugendo really requires a kind of multidisciplinary approach.
I think it does, precisely because of the nature of this particular tradition that extends across many, you know, many different groups of people and regions.
Hmm. And part three then kind of turns our attention to the narrative strategies that supported Shugendo groups and identities in pre-modern Japan. So we're talking about strategies such as iconography, poetic tropes, and representations in popular fiction and drama. So how was Shugendo narrated and represented in pre-modern Japan?
Again, we are only beginning to uncover this large cauldron of representations that are normally not very well studied. So these chapters here, they present a kind of a range of positions. So first of all, they begin with hagiographies in which early medieval authors from the like 1200s and 1300s are trying to trace the ascetic practices happening on particular mountains. They're trying to trace it back to both one founder, kind of more or less mythological, called Enno Gyoja, who is the patron saint, let's say, of Shugendo, and esoteric Buddhism. And since originally there is no connection, because Enno Gyoja lived and was active before esoteric Buddhism came in, so they're trying to make up for this lack of connections by involving the Indian patriarch Nagarjuna, for example, who was supposedly residing in some cave in some mountain in Japan, and he transmitted the esoteric teachings to Enno Gyoja while he was practicing on the mountain. So you see how narrative becomes a way to overcome spatial and temporal distance in historical events, because again, Nagarjuna from India ends up in Japan, because you have a gap of several hundred years between Enno Gyoja's life and the introduction of esoteric Buddhism to Japan, and you see that that can be spanned by this kind of mythopoetic narratives. So this is one aspect of what happens. And then you see that once a couple of narratives are in place about this connection, then they get proliferated and changed and embellished and transformed over several centuries. So this is the beginning of an important, let's say, literary or narrative tradition within many Shugendu groups. Then you have court poets using Chinese poetry, for example, like in the 11th, 12th century, using tropes from Chinese poetry to represent the mountain or some mountains where Shugendu practices were beginning to take place, which again is another addition. It shows that this is not so marginal as we thought, because again, court literati were interested in those happenings, in those ascetic practices. And later on, you see a proliferation of narratives about Shugenja and Yamabushi, both in theater, no theater, and kabuki, bundaku, and in popular narratives, especially in the Edo period. And what characterizes these later narratives, it's really a sense of ambivalence and ambiguity, in the sense that Yamabushi are presented as both powerful ascetics, you know, endowed with supernatural powers, and imposters. And sometimes you see those two things, you know, together in the same narrative. Sometimes you see only one of them. And again, this is very interesting because, again, the fact that a lot of people in early modern Japan saw the Yamabushi as imposters implies some kind of critical distance. But at the same time, the fact that there were so many Yamabushi in the Edo period, I read somewhere that probably 10% of the Japanese population were related to Shugendo. This is probably an exaggeration, I don't know. But the Yamabushi seems to have, you know, they were everywhere in Japan. It's not only on the top of the mountains as we imagine today. I mean, they were in the cities, in the marketplaces. They were traveling all over the country by foot, by boat, and all that. So they were everywhere. So they cannot only be seen as imposters, right? I mean, they really interfaced with important aspects of the Japanese society at the time. And so, again, this particular aspect is also deeply fascinating, I think, right? That you can see how some people can see the potential, you know, nature of the Yamabushi or Shugendo as a whole as imposters, but at the same time, the kind of needs, social needs that these people are catering to. And again, this is something that needs to be explored much more in depth. And iconography is similar, you know, you have Shugenja represented as like similar to some kind of wrathful deities from esoteric Buddhism, and sometimes they're similar to these kind of grotesque figures known as tengu, you know, kind of bird-like or crow-like figures, which suggests both the fact that there are not humans or beyond humans, but at the same time there's also this grotesque nature that is deeply troubling and unsettling, right? So it's a kind of a both way of sacredness, I think, right? The sacred as superior and the sacred as inferior that we find in many aspects of, you know, religiosity in many cultures.
Thank you. Yeah, this is super fascinating. I know that the edit volume is mostly focused on pre-modern Japan, Shugendo in pre-modern Japan, but I was just wondering, are these narratives and tropes about Shugendo still kind of pervasive in contemporary Japanese society?
I wouldn't say so. Of course, you can find a few like writers who use some of these tropes, but I wouldn't say so. You can find some of them in popular culture, I'm sure. I mean, I'm not an expert in manga or anime, but I wouldn't be surprised if some tropes coming, you know, related to Shugendo are part of this, you know, popular culture. But otherwise, you know, Shugendo are no longer so pervasive. You know, it's just a few groups of people doing certain things. I guess in some regions, like in Dewa Sanzan, you know, Haguro in the parts of northern Japan, or in other sacred mountains, they are more present in the villages, even today in the community, because, you know, some community members do that. But in most of Japan, Shugendo is not really a thing anymore. In fact, it's interesting to, you know, since you brought up, you know, this thing, this issue is that most, so when I talk to friends in Japan, for example, you know, when they tell me where they go to ski, you know, the most important ski resorts are former Shugendo mountains, oh, wow. But they don't know, right? So, whereas I don't know that they are ski resorts because I don't ski. So it's interesting to see how the knowledge is so different, right? Because they mentioned mountains. They say, oh, wow, that's a sacred mountain. And they say, no, that's a ski resort. So you see how things have changed over the last, like, I don't know, 80 years or so. And how this important and pervasive tradition has been really kind of neutralized in many ways.
Yeah, this is really interesting. Your other edit volume on maritime religion, the sea and the sacred, and also I guess the previous one that we talked about, animism and spirits, all kind of talk about the relationship between nature and human society, right? This kind of encroaching of human society onto natural landscape that was or that used to be considered sacred in many different ways. This is a very interesting phenomenon.
Yes, no, that now that you're pointing that out, you know, it makes me think that a lot of the, so after the humans encroached upon the sacred landscape and appropriated it for, let's say, secular purposes, then they came up with this narrative that, you know, nature is sacred and the Japanese love nature and all that, you know. But that it seems to be a consequence of the loss of the original sacredness of those places and this loss of the sacrality of the landscape has been replaced by a discourse, a very abstract discourse of that. And I don't know. I mean, this could be a topic for further inquiry, for sure.
Yeah, we look forward to another volume, hopefully, you will put out.
About that.
Yes. coming to the last part of the book, part four, entitled Materiality and Visual Culture, here the authors of the chapters present a variety of material sources, such as copper, statues, devotional paintings, stele, mounds, and paper talismans related to relevant figures and practices of the Shugendo tradition. So what can we learn about Shugendo from these material culture?
Well, I think that this is part of the turn to material culture that has been impacting the study of Japanese religions for the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years. And, I think we can learn a lot from these objects because they really go beyond, you know, the limits of traditional scholarship that was focusing on, like I said, on texts. And doctrines, and most of these texts in Shugendo were kind of secret texts, so they were not really circulating, you know, a whole lot. And extrapolating the essence of Shugendo from texts that very few people read, I mean, would be kind of a gross mischaracterization of the tradition. Whereas working on these kind of objects that are there available for pretty much everyone to see and use, you know, the devotional paintings, the stele, the mounds, paper talismans. Paper talismans were printed and circulated, you know, in the thousands. Mounds are scattered all over Japan and, you know, members of confraternities and Yamabushi themselves, you know, they go there and do their own celebrations and rituals there. Stele record. First of all, you have like a kind of popular iconographies that are not really part of any elite pantheon in some of these stele, but you also have records about who sponsored those, when and why. Sometimes you have the motivation behind the erection of a stele, and so that gives us a good sense of who were the people who were actually involved in this type of practices. And what kind of beliefs they had, you know, about divinities, what kind of rituals we're doing. So it really brings alive a lot of the Shugendo tradition that textual representations alone cannot really do. I should also say that by the Edo period, we have an incredible amount of written sources that are not only the doctrinal texts, right? You have diaries of Yamabushi, you have accounts of pilgrimages, you have records of visit to places, you have all kinds of documents that really document the vitality of Shugendo across many layers of society, you know, not only the practitioners and not only the elite monks, let's say, who were kind of part of that. But even so, I think materiality and visual culture really brings a completely different layer, completely different understanding of what was going on at the time. So I think it's crucial. And this is also, this part four is one of the, I think, most original. Well, I think, again, all the chapters in this book are quite original, each in their own way. But, you know, the focus on materiality and visual culture is relatively new, I think, in terms of Shugendo.
Interesting. Speaking of the material turn, so I was wondering, what are the new trends in Shugendo studies at the moment? What are the approaches that you would like to see young scholars take in the future?
Well, this sounds like self-advertisement, but I think that this book summarizes pretty well, I think, the current trends in scholarship, right? So attention to history and so what happened, when and why, right, in terms of the Shugendo tradition. Attention to history, attention to the social and cultural background of the various agents of the Shugendo galaxy, let's say, and the actors and the networks that, you know, were sustaining this tradition. This is what is happening in Japan today, and gradually it's also extending to other countries. Now, in terms of new approaches, something that I personally would like to see, okay, I've been working on Japanese religions for quite some time now, and I never really was. Maybe I shouldn't say so in public. But I have never really been able to figure out what Shugendo is, and working on this book finally gave me a sense of what, you know, a sense of what it is. Because again, Shugendo is not really another sect of Japanese Buddhism. It's not a widespread folk tradition because it has its own organizations. And at the same time, it is fairly fluid and flexible and pretty much on the margins. I mean, a lot of authorities, Tokugawa authorities, didn't like Shugenja precisely because of their mobility, precisely because they were kind of challenging the rigid social hierarchy that the Tokugawa government was trying to impose upon Japan. So working on this book, you know, I began to see, you know, the variety and the complexity of this phenomenon. So the fact that it cannot really be defined easily, because again, it's broad and widespread and fluid, but at the same time, you see its deep presence in many parts of Japan for several centuries. So in terms of new approaches, I would really like to see people focusing more on this, right? More on the role of Shugenja in society. If it is really true that there were thousands and thousands of Yamabushi, what they were doing? You know, how were people interacting to them? Not only in the mountains, but like in Edo, for example. We know that a lot of marketplaces, for example, from the 1400s until the 1800s were controlled by Yamabushi. Right. So what is the connection there? So we're not really talking about only people going up in the mountains and serving the village communities in those mountain areas. We're talking about big cities where Yamabushi go and do their own things in a way that was different from what other people were doing at the time. So this is, I think it's important to dig up more. So the role of Shugenja in society. I would like to see more on other sacred mountains. You know, a lot of people, especially here in the US and in Europe, are focusing on Mount Omine and the three mountains of Dewa in Tohoku. In Japan, a lot of people are focusing on Kumano and Mount Fuji for obvious reasons, right? I mean, those are important. But there are plenty of other mountains. Like I said, now most of them are ski resorts. But most of them are really important in their own region and not necessarily... They were not doing things similar to what other mountains that are more well known were doing. So I think it is really important to extend the study of Japanese religion beyond the traditional centers, right? Beyond Kyoto and the Kyoto region, including Kumano, Edo, Tokyo, right? And the region there, and to all other parts of Japan where a lot of things were happening, especially in the Tokugawa period, which is not a unified, as we all know, right? It's not a unified Japan, and there were a lot of regional varieties. Another aspect that I think is important and it's not been studied yet, especially outside of Japan, is the transition to Shinto. You know, in the late Tokugawa period, in the 1800s, Shinto priests from the Yoshida tradition and from other shrines become very active in many parts of Japan, and many Yamabushi actually begin to follow them. And so they kind of switch away from Buddhism and become Shinto practitioners, and that would be interesting to study and see why, you know, what happened there. And because, again, this is important to understand what happens then, you know, with the modernization process, when Shinto and Buddhism were kind of officially separated by a state edict. So, but again, there were already movements on the ground that made that separation possible. And the transition, you know, in the world of Shugendo from, let's say, Buddhist practitioners to so-called Shinto practitioners that happened in the 1800s is probably something that is relevant and needs to be studied more in depth.
Wow, this is very interesting. I can imagine how, you know, these different approaches, if they were taken, right, would reveal a very different kind of picture of Shugendo, very much involved in worldly affairs for start, right? So that would be interesting.
Yeah, and yes, exactly. But you see, it's all, again, we tend to think of rituals as like something boring going through the motions. But, you know, these people were, again, opening up markets. They were setting up the stages for performances. They were doing all kinds of, like, kind of sermons as entertainment. You know, these were kind of popular figures, right? They were attracting the attention of the people because, again, they were promoting their own interests. They were not boring. they could be controversial, but certainly not boring. So they added to the vitality of Japanese culture in pre-modern times in ways that have been gradually lost. I hear that some of these traditions still existed until immediately after World War II, right? And then with the rapid, how do you call it, like economic development that happened, you know, since the 50s, a lot of these things really disappeared, including in the provinces, in the countryside. So, but some people still have memory of that. I think, you know, so even like collecting like oral histories about these aspects would be important, you know, to preserve this aspect of the tradition. And I don't think we are doing enough of that.
Great. Well, I think we've taken up a lot of your time. And before we finish our interview today, we have one last question for you. Tell us about your current projects that you're working on right now.
Oh, so I keep working on the sea, trying to look for new sources and new materials. And one project that I have is the role of fish as divine animals. So I'm finding material on that. I mean, I found material. I'm trying to put it together. Because, again, when we talk about animals and the sacred, you always think about land-based animals, right? And in Japan, of course, fish is crucial, and there are a lot of fishes that are part of rituals or deified, and you know, things like that. So this is one. The other one is my ongoing project on the Japanese imperial music, gagaku, and especially I'm working on cultural history, one particular instrument, the sho, where I try to see the connections between materiality and immateriality, between like human intervention and limitations caused by the nature of the instrument itself. So that will be a kind of development of my early work on materiality and the sacred.
Thank you. It's you always have really exciting projects going on, so I'm sure our listeners will also be looking forward to them. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For
very kind.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show today.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you.